So hey guys, we're back, and today we have a wonderful guest. He's been on before. This is the second time. We have Mike Bell on the phone, and if you hear any snaps or crackles or sounds or anything, just remember that this is a digital phone call all the way overseas across the pond into the UK. But having Mike here is a blessing and a treasure for me, and I hope for you. If you want to go back and listen to our very first interview, that was on January 14th of 2023, and you can hear Mike Bell's story about how he got into Western history and his jobs and how his jobs took him traveling. And it's really, I listened to it just the other day, and it's a fantastic story. So please go back and listen to the January 14th, 2023. The podcast name is Mike Bell, His Story. Before we get into the podcast, of course, we want to thank our friends at the Tombstone Epitaph, one of Arizona's longest-running newspaper. You can subscribe online at tombstoneepitaph.com. And, of course, our second family, Mike, too. I know he's a member of the WWHA at Wild West History Association. You can join for about $75 at wildwesthistory.org. We've got a ton of stuff going on all year long. And we got some wonderful things happening with the journal. And our 2023 roundup just ended in San Antonio, Texas. And we're already planning for next year, 2024, at Fort Smith, Arkansas. I cannot wait to see you there. And hopefully Mike can make the journey across the pond. If not, we'll definitely do some live video feeds like I did at the last one, so that all of you that can't be there, you can be there at least by watching a live video feed. Again, that's Wild West History Association at wildwesthistory.org. I believe Mike wrote a book. It was in 2019. It was called "Who Are Those Guys of Myths and Manhunters? The Union Pacific Bandit Hunters." He wrote a book. It's about 82 pages long. If you want to find out this book, go to lulu.com. It's just like it sounds, lulu.com, and you can find all of Mike's books in there for sale, and he can get them right out to you. And this one is for sale. It's in a softback. It sells for around $12.45, for a paperback, not a softback. And you can get it right to your door. There might be some shipping costs involved, but Mike will let you know that, especially if you're purchasing it in the States or Canada or Australia. He can definitely take care of you there. But go to lulu.com to find all of Mike Bell's books. Also, a big shout out to the English Westerner Society. That is a group of people that are keeping the Wild West alive in the UK, and they are a fantastic group. I was looking at their site, and I'm thinking I might join. I'm thinking I might send the $30. Is it still $30?
It is, and you can send it to me because I'm the treasurer. So, by all means, Mike, okay. Go for it.
I'm thinking I'm going to join because the thing is there's a lot of people writing Western history books in the UK that I'm looking at that I don't think they're getting the credit that they deserve, and maybe we can get them on the podcast and tell their stories as well.
Oh, yeah.
So that Mike Bell doesn't, I don't ask Mike one question and he spends the next 55 minutes answering one question. I give him a hard time because he still holds the record for the longest time spent answering one question. Now, John Bosnecker almost got him, but not quite. But Mike holds that record. So welcome, sir. How are you?
I'm doing good. Good. Really well. Really glad to be here. Thank you for the shout out for the English Westerners. They've been around since 1954. We're coming up for our 70th anniversary next year. So there'll be a load of special publications coming out that might be of interest to people listening to the podcast.
Well, in that, you must have your own journal, one type of journal or publication that goes
That's
out,
right?
Because I saw that shipping and handling, you know, it goes out. Is that correct, or is that a paper?
Yeah, what it is, well, there's a publication called The Brand Book, which is in card covers. That comes out three times a year, and that's original researched material on all aspects of the Old West from about 1850 onwards. So there tends to be quite a bit on Indian Wars history, a lot of outlaw lawman history, but all aspects of the West. And that's complemented by the tally sheet, which I think is about the equivalent of the Wild West History Association saddlebag. So that's more about news about members, book reviews, forthcoming events, and so on. Now, we're still a bit behind the times here in the UK, so the saddlebag's now online, but the tally sheet comes out as a hard copy. And those publications come out three times a year. We're just working on the summer or the late summer 2023 publications, which will be hitting members hopefully late August, early September.
And do you have a website?
$30 well spent.
Do you have a website for that?
There is. If you go to EnglishWesterners, I think it's .org. The website's a bit out of date because the guy who does the work on it for us is tied up with events in Ukraine right now. But there's a website for English Westerners and its sister association, the Custer Association of Great Britain, which, as the name says, is a website and publications for those who are interested in the 1876 Sioux campaigns.
Awesome. Well, you guys heard it. If you want to join that, been around for a long time, probably they have a lot of back issues and journals and things like that that you can study and research. But I think it's great that they're keeping the West alive in the UK. And there's a huge, I've looked at some of the stuff online. There's a huge popularity with the American Western history, Wild West history in the UK. So that's probably one of the best places to start.
It is. And actually some of our guys, sadly both dead now, but they were for a while, the leading authors on their topic. So Joe Rosa, who some of your listeners may have heard of, right, who wrote about Wild Bill. He, for many years, was the world's leading authority on Wild Bill Hickok. Fred Nolan, who sadly died earlier on this year,
right,
he was and remains one of the foremost authorities on Billy the Kid. So it just goes to show, you know, like Peter Brand in Australia or whatever, that sometimes distance is no barrier to doing high-quality research and publishing well-respected material.
Well, one of those well-respected materials is your book.
Nice segue there, Mike.
You like that?
That was very good. You think we'd rehearsed that?
I didn't. When I have the English on the phone, I feel myself elevated to a higher standard. And especially you, because you're so detailed. I'm not joking about that. You're so detailed, and we've spoken before. You're so detailed in your answers that I forget that I've got to talk, and I'll just sit there and just listen to you tell about the history, and I love every minute of it. You wrote a book, though, in 2019 called, again, Who Are Those Guys of Myths and Manhunters, the Union Pacific Bandit Hunters. It follows a story in the history that says that by 1901, the Union Pacific had run out of patience.
Yeah.
There were two train robberies in 2 years, one in Wilcox, Wyoming in 1899, and one in Tipton, Wyoming in 1900s.
That's right.
Guards have been placed on trains after the Wilcox robbery, but clearly did not deter anybody from robbing the Tipton train. Then in January 1902, William Canada, head of the Union Pacific Secret Service Division, it says, hired former North Platte, Nebraska Sheriff, Timothy T. Kelleher, is that right?
Yeah, Timothy Thaddeus Kelleher.
There you go. To bring together a group or a force that would hunt down and destroy any further gangs of train robbers.
Yep, that's right.
Did that happen, and expand on that? Can you tell that whole story?
Yeah, well, when you and I talked about doing this second conversation, I was thinking again about our first conversation and how I got into all of this, and my interest in Butch Cassidy being stimulated by the movie. Now, it then occurred to me, of course, I think of myself as being still a young thing at the age of 67. So there may still be some people out there for whom the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid movie is meaningless. so be it. But that's what prompted my interest in the Bandit Hunters. There's a scene in the film where Butch and Sundance have been chased halfway around the West. Let me go back a step. There are two train robberies in the movie, and they're great theatre, lovely entertainment, as is the film. But they're just full of errors. For example, they both take place in the daylight, whereas the train robberies took place at night. And in the second train robbery, Paul Newman, alias Butch, and Robert Redford, alias Sundance, have just blown apart the express car, and there's money floating down to the ground, and the outlaws are scrabbling around trying to get it. Yeah. And in the distance, a train, a small train with just two cars, pulls into view mm-hmm. and slowly approaches the train robbery site, and then it stops. And for a few seconds, there's just silence. And then the train whistle blows, and the car doors burst open, and a posse of horsemen come flying out of the train, thundering towards the train robbers. And Newman, as Cassidy says, whatever it is they're selling, I don't want it. And they flee. And they're chased halfway around the West. They finally get back to their hideout and meet Etta Place, who explains to them that Edward Harriman, who's the owner of the Union Pacific, has had enough of their train robberies. And he's employed this force of manhunters, including Joe LaFors and various other people, LaFors being a famous Wyoming detective, and that they're going to stay on the trail. And Butch says, well, how long is that going to be? And Etta says, until you're dead. So the implication is that the Bandit Hunters, as they were called, were instrumental in making Butch and Sundance decide to go to South America. So it's a great story. Unfortunately, as you'd now expect from me, I have to say it, almost all of that's completely untrue. Story begins with William Canada, William Zachary Taylor Canada. He was born in 1847 in Kentucky, fought briefly in the Civil War as a teenager, and then his family went west to Nebraska, where he served as a police constable, a police judge, a variety of public functions in Nebraska City. And in 1891, he was hired by the Union Pacific as a claims adjuster. And at the time, the Union Pacific, the main crimes the Union Pacific was suffering from was either fraud, people claiming that stuff had been stolen from trains, or genuine theft. But it wasn't train robbery as we currently understand it. There had been some major train robberies on the UP back in the 1870s. Sam Bass and co had robbed trains, and then Big Nose George Parrott had robbed a train and been hung and skinned alive and all of that. And that's a whole different story. But in the main, railroads suffered from petty theft. People stealing packages from express cars, people breaking into trains at night and stealing coal. So that was the type of theft that Canada was brought in to deal with. And by August 1900, Canada was interviewed by the Omaha Press. And he was being a bit smug at the time. And he said, there have only been five robberies of the Union Pacific since I took a post, and we sorted them all out. And nobody is left around from those robberies. He was correct in that there were five robberies. There was a train robbery on the outskirts of Denver in 1892. There was one near Brady Island, Nebraska in 1895. There was a spate of depot robberies in North Bend, Nebraska in 1897. And then there was the famous Wilcox train robbery carried out by various outlaws, which may or may not have included Cassidy, in June 1899. There's another one. Oh, sorry. And then just before Canada was interviewed, there was another train robbery in Hugo, Colorado. And in all the cases, the train robbers were brought to justice. The problem with Canada's story, however, was that in most cases, the Union Pacific had little or nothing to do with the captures and the arrests. It was local lawmen, local sheriffs, local constables, local marshals, whatever, who brought them in. So he was being at best elastic with the truth when he was interviewed in August 1900. The North Bend robberies were led by a guy called Big Mike Wagoner. And Wagoner, one of the things that I'm working on for an update to the book is the saga of Wagoner. There was about 8 or 9 depot robberies in that era where Wagoner and his gang would arrive at a depot late at night when there's usually only one person on duty, and they'd stick up the station master and say, empty the safe. So there's this long interview, which I'm going to include as an appendix in the update of the book, where Canada, you know, one can imagine him. He's in his 50s now. He's on top of his job as far as he's concerned. He's sitting back in his leather armchair or his, you know, captain's chair in his office in Omaha, whiskey in one hand, cigar in the other. The reporter sitting there wide-eyed. Ooh, Mr. Canada, tell me your adventures. So what I've done in the update to the book is to delve into these stories, to tell about these events that led to the bandit hunters coming into being. So this interview is given in, I forget, about the 19th of August, 1900. And Canada's basically saying, if you rob a Union Pacific train, you know, there is no hope for you. And it's unlikely it'll ever happen again. 2 weeks later, mm-hmm. Outlaws hit the Union Pacific again at Tipton and get away with a significant amount of money. And it was that event that led to a crisis conference between William Canada, Harriman, who was the owner of the Union Pacific, and probably several other guys, although I'm not exactly clear who, that led to the formation of the bandit hunters. And you're right in what you said earlier on. In the aftermath of the Wilcox robbery, the Union Pacific had hired a number of men as guards to ride the trains. But they didn't have enough men to guard every train, and they didn't have enough men to guard every stretch of the line from Omaha, Nebraska, all the way to Salt Lake. So they tended to concentrate on what they called the Bandit Belt, which was between Cheyenne and Evanston in Wyoming. And even then, they could only put one guard on each train. And even then, not every train. So it was potluck if you happened to have a guard on your train. And it's clear from the accounts of the Tipton robbery that the outlaws knew about this, because the first thing they ask the train crew when they stop the train is, are there any guards on this train? And they make it quite clear in no uncertain terms that if the train crew lie to them, they're going to suffer. So by the time we get to the late summer of 1900, Canada's reputation is a bit tarnished because the train guards clearly haven't worked. Also, they were only ever hired part-time. They brought them in the spring when the weather got better and then laid them off in the winter. So it meant you never got continuity of train guards. In the book, I detail some of the histories of these guys, and they range from guys who are respected ranchers, ranch foremen, lawmen, former prison guards, all the way through to guys whose record is a bit patchy, to say the least. There's a guy called Ed Blanchard, for example, who resigned after one season with the Union Pacific and then murdered his neighbor in the 1920s. Falling out of, they owned dude ranches, and there was rivalry and all sorts of stuff. So the bandit hunters, I will stop in a second, I promise, Mike. The bandit hunters come into being early in the year 1902, when the current chief of detectives for the line between Salt Lake and Cheyenne, a guy called Frank Wheeler, is dismissed. And he has a whole history that is talked about in the book. He's served with Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. He'd been city marshal of Nebraska City. He'd been a constable. He'd done all sorts of things. And to be fair, he'd done his job diligently. He chased after the Wilcox train robbers and the Tipton train robbers. But because they were much better organized with relays of horses, and they're operating in countryside in which they're regarded, if not as heroes, then the population is at least ambivalent towards the railroads. So if the population doesn't actively support the train robbers, they don't go out of their way to give them away. to the Union Pacific detectives who come thundering in demanding money and fresh horses and all this sort of stuff. So it's those events, it's those five events that Canada was being so smug about that led to the formation of the Bandit Hunters in January 1902.
Well,
I shall pause for breath.
You can keep going.
Okay. Well, can I have a swig of coffee first?
Well, because you wrote much of what you've said already, which is, says that in their first year, the Union Pacific Mounted Rangers, or popularly known as the Bandit Hunters, were led by
Arthur Grosvenor Porter. Yeah.
There you go, Arthur. I can't even say that one name. Which was a cousin of Teddy Roosevelt.
That's right. He's an interesting character in his own right. But like all these guys, you have to separate fact from fiction. He was born in Maryland in about 1867 and sent to a military academy, a kid's military academy. Then his parents died, so he's raised by his aunt. He's related to Teddy Roosevelt through Roosevelt's sister, who married the guy who's Porter's father, whatever. He's related through his through Roosevelt's sister, who was the mother of Grover Porter. Grover Porter's father, Seth Porter, had been the commander of a Confederate raider in the Civil War. And his history is interesting in its own right. He disappears into Europe. He died in Berlin in the 1920s. But if you go into the Roosevelt archives, there's correspondence between Seth Grover Porter and Teddy Roosevelt, as well as between Arthur Grover Porter and Roosevelt. So the young Porter read about Teddy Roosevelt's adventures in the Dakotas and was inspired to become a cowboy. So he runs away from this military academy to Nebraska and then Wyoming, where he works on ranches for a while. He changed his name briefly to, I think it's Grover Arthur. I've forgotten. I should read my own book. But then he reappears. And in the aftermath of the Johnson County Range War in the spring of 1892, there was a political controversy because the Wyoming U.S. Marshal, Joe Rankin, was accused of not enforcing the law. It was alleged that he refused to send deputies into Johnson County to police the county and keep the lid on what had been a very violent affair. So Rankin hires a whole new bunch of deputy United States Marshals, of whom Arthur Grover Porter is one. Five of them then resign because one of the marshals, a ranch foreman called George Wellman, is gunned down just outside Buffalo, Wyoming. And five of the eight decide that they have better ways to spend their time other than being shot at by rustlers. But three of them, a guy called Jim Huff, Grover Porter, and the third man, whose name will come back to me, they do their job. They're stationed in Johnson County for several months before they're finally pulled out. On the back of that, Porter starts working for prestigious ranches in Wyoming, which actually he'd done before the Johnson County War. And he specializes in horses. It's at that point that, it's in that 8 years between the end of the Johnson County War and 1900 that he acquires a reputation as a frontiersman, somebody who knows horses inside out. And it doesn't hurt that he has heavyweight political connections through Roosevelt, who, of course, rises from being governor of New York through vice president and ultimately on the back of McKinley being shot to become president. Roosevelt visits Wyoming in 1903. If you go into the archives in Laramie, there's a whole host of photographs of Roosevelt's famous ride. He got a train to Denver, then to Cheyenne, then to Laramie. He made a speech at the university in Laramie. And then he and his party, including Grover Porter, who'd been charged with protection duty, ride north from Laramie to the Van Tassel Ranch. Van Tassel is a hugely wealthy supporter of Roosevelt and his party. And then they ride down into Cheyenne via the road that's still there, although it's long since been bypassed, the Happy Jack Road. So there are loads of photographs of this. Just before that event, Porter had spent a year commanding the Bandit Hunters. And what they had done was they had a special train, as per the movie, in which they had the best horses money could buy, or Ed Harriman's money could buy, smokeless rifles, because the outlaws had been using smokeless rifles in their exploits, which had made it difficult to see where they were firing from. So, for example, in the aftermath of the Wilcox robbery, Natrona County Sheriff Joe Hazen is gunned down by the outlaws, and the posse can't see where the firing is coming from, which puts them at a major disadvantage, so they retreat. The bandit hunters are given the best horses, the best guns, and the best men that money can buy at that time. So for about 2 years in the summer months, because few train robberies take place in a Wyoming winter for fairly obvious reasons, for about 2 years, the special train is run out of Laramie or Cheyenne, up and down the line from between those two cities and Evanston. And at random points, it'll be sidetracked. The bandit hunters get out, and they make great play publicly of exercising their horses, riding hell for leather along the tracks. And that the Union Pacific has a major publicity campaign talking about the bandit hunters and how they're protecting the bandit belt from the worst desperados the world's ever seen, and so on. And this is where the myth and legend of the bandit hunters overlaps, because in many of the early books on Butch Cassidy, you'll see photographs taken of the bandit hunters in the rail yards in Cheyenne. And there's about half a dozen pictures of the bandit hunters lined up with the high-powered rifles and their horses. And there's a guy called Silas Funk, who's an ex-Nebraska lawman. There's George Hyatt, who is the foreman of a ranch in Wyoming. There's Tim Kelleher, the former North Platte sheriff. There's Joe LaFors, who was Deputy United States Marshal for Wyoming for a long time. And there's, what's his name? High something or other. It'll come back to High Davis. There's two Davises. High Davis, who was a veteran of the Spanish-American War and the Philippine Wars, who was their horse hostler, but also went into the field. And there's an aging guy called Sure Shot Davis, who had been a Wells Fargo guard in the Black Hills in the 1870s. So all these guys line up and their photographs are taken, and there's pictures of them loading the horses onto the railroad car, and there's a picture of them inside the railroad car. And for years, these pictures appeared in publications on Cassidy saying, here's the posse that went after them after Wilcox or after Tipton. The problem is, of course, they weren't formed until 1902. Only a handful of them ever came close to Cassidy or a train robber, and they were disbanded probably in 1906. The three that ever saw Cassidy were probably Sam Lawson, who had a long and respected history as a lawman, but he'd served as a penitentiary guard as well while Cassidy was in the prison in Laramie, so he would have known Cassidy by sight. Joe LaFors, the Deputy United States Marshal. We know from some of the work you and I have talked about in the past that both LaFors and Cassidy were in Buffalo, Wyoming in the fall of 1890. In fact, their signatures appear on the same page of the Occidental Hotel Register, which I think you and your wife are going to go and have a look at some point. Mm-hmm. But so LaFors may or may not have seen Cassidy. And the third candidate is an English guy whose story I wrote up at the English Western Society. He's a guy called Tom Meginson, or Meginson. He was born in England, in the north of England, in the 1860s. Family died. He emigrated to the United States. He turns up in Utah, in Vernal, in the early 1890s as a minor criminal. And he's arrested for stealing horses and cattle and so forth by a deputy called Joe Tolliver. And then his story goes quiet. Then he pops up again as a bandit hunter. Now, he's in the same place, Vernal, as Cassidy is in the 1890s, so it's possible he may have known Cassidy. The other thing he was known for is in the aftermath of the Wilcox robbery, there was speculation about who carried out the crime. And immediately, even though the evidence is almost non-existent, Butch Cassidy's name appears, as does the name of outlaw Flatnose George Curry. George Sutherland Curry is a Canadian from, I think it's Newfoundland or anyway, somewhere on the east coast of Canada, who ends up in Nebraska in the 1880s where he works in a store and then as a cowboy. And slowly but surely goes bad. He may have been in Sundance, Wyoming at the same time the young Sundance kid was in jail there. So he's the prime candidate to be the leader of the Wilcox train robbers. And he's located on the Green River in Utah in April of 1900. A posse that's looking for somebody else almost literally falls over him. He's on his hands and knees with the corpse of a cow that he's killed and is butchering when this posse rides up. He backs away with his rifle. The posse backs away. There's a bit of gunfire. And Flatnose disappears into the canyonlands. But the posses keep on after him. And included in the posse is this Englishman, Tommy Megason. And they finally overhaul him, I think, it's the 21st of April, 1900. The posse split, so they're on either side of the Green River. They come across Flatnose George again on a sandbar in the river. And he's on foot by this time because his horses have fled. He's got his rifle. He's got his bridle. He's clearly trying to find his stock. He's told to surrender. You know, he's wanted for a variety of things, but he refuses. He scampers into some rocks, and there's an exchange of rifle fire, long-range rifle fire from the posse, and George doesn't reply. And when they finally get up the courage to go and have a look at him, he's been dead for a while. He's been shot through the head. So Tommy Megason is one of the other bandit hunters. He had quite a track record, both as a minor outlaw and as a lawman. So one can understand why he was hired as a bandit hunter. And in fact, all of the guys who are bandit hunters, when you dig into their stories, which is what I did in this little book, have creditable and credible records as bandit hunters. But their employer, the Union Pacific, inflates their importance as a deterrent to prevent train robbers having a go at the Union Pacific again. And one might argue it works because between the Tipton robbery of August 1900 and the lone bandit Will Carlisle hitting the Union Pacific in 1916, there are no train robberies of any significance. There's one event in 1904 when the bandit hunters are called on to go into action. A switchman at a little tiny halt called Arsay, which is named after a Chinese dignitary from Rock Springs who tried to negotiate better terms and conditions for Chinese workers. This guy, Frank Uckley, telegraphs the UP and says, bandits have tried to rob a train. I fought them off and all of this. So the bandit hunters all assemble. They're a bit like a lifeboat crew in this country, that they're doing other things, but they can get to their train in about 30 minutes. So they get to their train, they go charging down the track, and they start looking for the train robbers. And this guy, Utley, has claimed that there were, at least a dozen train robbers who attacked him, and he was brave to hold them off with his pistol. What he's forgetting is the bandit hunters are experienced lawmen and experienced trackers. And Sam Lawson and Tom Megason come back in from the field and say, there is no trace of half a dozen or a dozen train robbers crashing around the countryside here. Would you like to tell us what actually happened? And one can imagine this little dark shack in the desolate parts of Wyoming where this guy, this switchman, is being eyeballed by the bandit hunters, Joe LaFors, Tommy Megason and others. And he cracks and he basically admits he made the whole thing up, that he wanted to get the reward. That's probably the swan song of the bandit hunters. From there, they go back into Cheyenne, and the photographs, you talked about Jim McCubbin in our pre-talk. Bob McCubbin. In Bob McCubbin's collection is an original picture of the bandit hunters. And it says on the back that the photograph was taken on the 4th of August, I think, or whatever date in August 1904, and then sent to the Union Pacific Secret Service Department in Omaha. So we know almost to the day when those photographs were taken, which is 4 years after Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid left America to go to South America. But then there's a sort of afterthought to the story, in that, ironically, if that's the right term, the guy who was the head of the Secret Service in Wyoming before he was sacked, Frank Wheeling, he worked for Buffalo Bill. He traveled with Buffalo Bill to the United Kingdom. He performed before Queen Victoria as part of Buffalo Bill's show. And when he came back to the United States, He was hired by the UP for many years. And Buffalo Bill re-enters the story at this point because Buffalo Bill and his Wild West show have been in Europe for many years. Buffalo Bill comes back. He hears about the train robberies. He comes out to Wyoming and he tries to hire some of the men who'd been either bandit hunters or in the posses that went after the Tipton and Wilcox train robbers. And these are largely hard-bitten, cynical ranchmen, lawmen. They've got no particular interest in the, you know, Buffalo Bill's mythologized version of the West. So the press is kind in its terminology. It says something like, all the men whom Bill offered a place in his show declined politely. I suspect they might have used saltier language than that in telling Bill where to go. But Bill carries on, and he has mocked up a railroad engine. It's a flatbed truck, a 1903 or 5 flatbed truck, which he has mocked up to look like a railroad engine. So in his tour, which begins in Madison Square Garden, runs for 3 weeks in Madison Square Garden in 1906, I think it is, and it's a huge sellout tour. I mean, this makes Taylor Swift look like a nothing. The amount of money and tickets that Buffalo Bill sells in his tours is just phenomenal. So the train robbers and the bandit hunters live again in the form of this fictionalized version where this train pulls into the ring, the bandits hold up the train and the train pulls out, and then the bandit hunters swoop into the arena and there's a gunfight and they're all killed and all of that. And that goes on for a couple of years, by which time the Union Pacific is still running stories way up into the 19-teens about the bandit hunters, even though their last probable action was about 1904, 1905. So when that photograph was taken in the stockyards in Cheyenne, just before Cheyenne's frontier days in 1904, the guys lined up, they drape themselves in gun belts, they smile at the camera and look a bit embarrassed and all of that. And then off they go for a few beers and to take part in the horse races and the drinking competitions and whatever. And they think nothing of it. But what they've actually done is they've created a legend, because those photographs still persist in volumes on Butch Cassidy, claiming they represent the posse that went after the Wild Bunch after the Tipton train robbery, which it didn't. Did I beat John Bosnagger?
No, it. You're the perfect guest. And Peter, really? If Peter Brand, you're listening, Peter, nobody will beat you as a guest. But you're the perfect guest.
Peter Brand's Australian. That doesn't count.
Yes, there you go. The perfect Australian guest, and you're the perfect English guest. And the reason being is because there's so much. Now, if you were listening to this, this is Mike Bell. You can find his books on Lulu.com, and he's a member of the English Westerner Society, Brand Bank, and a fabulous group in the UK, Keeping the Wild West Alive. But again, if you want his books, please go to Lulu.com. The reason that Mike is the perfect guest is I ask a simple question, and then I literally shut up and learn just like you do. And remember, he's got some notes, but almost everything that he just said was off the top of his head. And it's that I usually, when I interview researchers and they can do this off the top of the head, it's because they're passionate about that subject and they've memorized it and they've learned it and they've read it and they've researched it. Really fabulous. So great answers. Whatever became of the group, whatever became of them? I mean, did they eventually break apart, railroad robbery yeah. stop, and then they didn't see a need for it? Was it just a natural progression?
Yeah, that was the thing, really, that by 1905, things are changing radically. In fact, I'm doing some work on an update to the book, right. And several things are changing. One is, in the aftermath of the Wilcox train robbery, this is before the bandit hunters, Frank Wheeling, who's then the head of the Wyoming part of the line, he and a guy called John Vizard, who's another UP detective, they lead the immediate chase after the outlaws and don't get anywhere other than getting Joe Hazen killed. And that's all down to Vizard making a terrible mistake. But they hire a guy briefly called Fred Hands, who's a Nebraska railroad detective from a different line, but he has a reputation of hunting people down. And he fails as well. By the time he gets into the field, the countryside is so awash with posses and cowboys and amateur bandit hunters and Pinkertons and all that, cluttering up the place. He says that he comes back in and says, look, there's no chance of catching these guys in a hot pursuit now. But what he does say is the train robbery is, first of all, a much more expensive thing for the outlaws than people might think, because the amount of time and money they had to spend on information and intelligence and on relays of horses and paying off ranchers and people in the field whom they come across takes a heck of a lot out of whatever they actually managed to steal. He also says that the area in which train robbery can be carried out at all successfully is shrinking because of telephones. What he says is, because we've now got long-distance telephones, ranchers can call each other up, or they can call into the local town and say, I've just seen the train robbers heading up whatever it is, Kirby Creek or Gibson Gulch or whatever it is. So the pursuit by 1905 is getting easier. Also, banking has changed. If you read the accounts of train robberies, there's a period where train robbery is popular because they're shifting specie or currency from place to place. So that the bank robbers ideally want gold because you can trade that and it's not traceable. If they can't have gold, they want currency, preferably already signed by the president of the bank. But if not, they'll do it themselves, which is what happens after Tipton. And that's what gets Kid Curry and others jailed, not for train robbery, but for forging the signatures on the currency. But pretty swiftly, it comes down to checks and bank transfers. So the need to actually shift physical cash from place to place diminishes. Stamps, on the other hand, are a different thing. A lot of the train robberies and train thefts in the latter half of the first decade of the 20th century are all about stamps. That once you've nicked them from a train or from a depot, the stamp is still a tradable unit of currency. You can go into a post office or whatever and exchange it. So that all changes. And Hans is the guy who really analyzes train robbery very, very succinctly and efficiently. And that means by 1905, 1906, the bandit hunters and the old idea of a posse thundering off to a train robbery site in a hot pursuit after the train robbers has disappeared. So they're largely stood down. Most of them just, it's almost like, what's that John Wayne movie? The one where he dies of old age, or he dies in a saloon brawl at, anyway, you know the one I'm talking about.
True Grit, I think.
Is that True Grit with Lauren Bacall? And anyway, he's an aging lawman and all of that sort of stuff. So many of them die of old age. Some of them live very long lives. Arthur Grover Porter, the guy who was Roosevelt's nephew, he clings on to Roosevelt's coattails for a while. After he's done with the bandit hunters, he goes to work for the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Then Roosevelt appoints him as the U.S. Marshal in eastern Oklahoma. In the Indian Territory, I beg your pardon. And then as statehood is coming up, Roosevelt nominates him and a guy called Wolf Catcher, Jack Abernathy, as marshals for what will become the new state of Oklahoma. But all sorts of objections are lodged to that, those appointments, mainly to do with opposition in the Senate to Roosevelt, but partly to do with rumors of both men skimming off money in their previous jobs, which don't appear to have any foundation to them. But again, Roosevelt sees his cousin through. He appoints Porter as chief of police of the Panama Canal Zone, which he does for another year. Then he comes back to the United States. He's given an appointment in the Secret Service. He spends time on the West Coast chasing down gangs of forgers and counterfeiters. And then his career becomes a little murky. His effects were auctioned off a few years ago, and they include interesting things. There's a medal that was issued to Americans for their support for the Japanese in World War I. I've yet to find any record of Porter playing a role in that front in World War I. But his obituaries say he served in the intelligence service, the Secret Service, and then the intelligence service. Now, it's the Secret Service that goes after counterfeiters. The intelligence service was working on intelligence in World War One. So maybe he has something going on there that we've yet to find. He is finally killed in 1948. He divorced his first wife, or she divorced him, because he was chasing other women. He shaves 10 years off his age and marries again to a lady called Ruby Cowley. And they live in Dallas, but they have a summer home in Bentonville, Arkansas. And in 1948, the summer of 1948, they're driving from Dallas to Bentonville in the dead of night. And the old marshal, who claims he's 70, but is actually nearer 80 by this point, he loses control of the car, rolls off the road. His wife's badly injured. He's very, very badly injured and dies in hospital. Tim Kelleher, the guy who brought together the Rangers, he left the Union Pacific in about 1910. Bill Canada left to go to the Indiana Central in Chicago. Tim Kelleher followed him, as did a couple of the other bandit hunters. So Tommy Meganson stayed with the UP for a while, but then followed Canada and Kelleher to the IC. He died in 1954, Tim Kelleher. By the time he died, his legend was overwhelming him as well. So he gave radio talks and newspaper talks in which he talks about how he and his bandit hunters wiped out the Wild Bunch. And he spoke at length about what an evil character Butch Cassidy was and this and that and the other, even though it's fairly clear he never met Butch Cassidy. Mm. And actually, the man himself was a perfectly honorable employee of the Union Pacific. He'd served as a said a moment ago, I think he served as sheriff of Otoe County or North Platte County in Nebraska. He'd served as constable. He had an exemplary record as a lawman. He didn't need to make up stories by the time he got to that age, but either he or the press did. So by the time we get to the end of the lives of these guys, I think Keller is the last to go in 1954. By that time, historians or quasi-historians such as Charles Kelly have begun writing up anecdotes of Butch Cassidy's life, and they just draw from the newspapers without any sort of critical judgment. So they just suck in these stories that talk about the bandit hunters chasing after Butch Cassidy and how there's all, you know. So the mythology, which began with the Buffalo Bill Wild West show in the 1880s, from which some of the bandit hunters came, the mythology and the real story are interlocked from 1880 onwards and are cemented in place with the death of the last of the bandit hunters in 1954.
God, that's crazy. Well, if you're wondering who we're talking to, this is Mike Bell. You can find his books on lulu.com as well as Amazon and booksellers near you. He's got an extensive collection. This is, I think, our first or second book. We've got a ton more to talk about, and hopefully he'll come back for more. Will you come back for more?
Well, of course I will, because from what you tell me, it gives you a rest. You sit there with your boots on the table drinking coffee while I just rabbit on telling stories.
I'm actually in my shorts and a T-shirt, no shoes, because it's really hot here in Arizona. So that the microphone won't pick up the background noise, I turn the air off. So right now it's about 90 degrees Fahrenheit in my house. Yeah, wonderful. But I want to get the story, and I want it to be clear for our listeners. Again, it's Mike Bell. You can find all his books at lulu.com. That's lulu.com. You say you're working on some stuff, addendums to this. Do you have any brand new book that you're working on?
Well, let me go back. Yes, we're hoping to publish a much expanded book on the bandit hunters next year under the title of Let Not the Guilty Escape, which was apparently the motto of the Union Pacific Secret Service. So that's okay. Going to be hopefully coming out. We've just published, which you mentioned is on Amazon, The Day the Train Robbers Came, which is the story of Kid Curry's last train robbery, but told from the perspective of the train crew and the posse men who went out after the train robbers. And I've just published a book called Blood on the Big Horn, which is a companion to the book we talked about last time, Wyoming Outlaws. It's the discovery of a saloon ledger from the saloon of a guy called Henry Sherrod, who had a sawdust and plank saloon on the Bighorn River in the 1890s. And the ledger lists all the men who drank in his saloon, including Butch Cassidy and various other people. So there's an analysis of that ledger with some new material just been published.
Okay. Otherwise, I was going to tell you you're a flake and that you're sitting around the house doing nothing all day long. But
yeah, sorry.
I can't say that because you're busy. I asked this question last time about we have a few minutes, about 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay.
About the time machine. I'm not going to ask you about the time machine.
Okay.
Unless you want me to do the time machine question. It's up to you.
What's the other question you're going to ask?
I was going to ask you is usually somebody has something about them that nobody knows. Like when I interviewed Chuck Parsons, Chuck said that he'll drive for miles to this one little restaurant to get deep fried mushrooms in ranch dressing. Is there something about you, a food, maybe a song that is a must listen to, something that, you know, I mean, nothing secret, but I mean something about you that only maybe your wife and your family knows, that you like a specific food or a favorite food or, you know, something about you, music, a book, a movie that's a must see or do?
Well, I love Mexican food.
Oh.
I am fortunate in that I have a couple of friends who are really good chefs of Mexican cuisine. I love a good chili. Hmm. Music-wise, I think we talked about this before when we were talking about music. I like all sorts of music, but I was sort of born in the 50s, so I was sort of coming to fruition in terms of music in the 70s. So I love early Elton John, for example, when he was more of a country rock singer, and some of his early albums are stories about the old West. But there's little, I'm afraid, my wife and daughter don't know about me that the rest of the world doesn't already. They just tolerate my obsession by American lawmen and outlaws, really.
And dead
for which I'm interminably grateful.
Okay. Well, the Mexican food is great because hopefully we can bring you to Arizona and we've got some wonderful Mexican food places that'll burn your cheeks and tongue. Mm. But it's fantastic. So, well, good to know.
Yeah.
Well,
I'm up for that.
Again, we have Mike Bell again. And I emphasize this, please go to lulu.com or Amazon and look up Mike Bell. You might have to get a little bit deep into the research because there's a lot of Mike Bells. So make sure you go Mike Bell Western History or Old West History in order to bring that up. Lulu will be a lot easier because that's their group website. And you've got a search bar and you put Mike Bell in there and everything comes up. Of course, I want to thank, too, our mutual friends at the Wild West History Association at wildwesthistory.org. Please join. We'd love to have you as a member and as a family member and get all the cool things that you get from being WWHA. And our friends over at the Tombstone Epitaph, can subscribe online, get the epitaph delivered right to your door. It's an actual newspaper, and you get it delivered right to your door. And there's wonderful articles and history and stuff and pictures, Bob Bozbell. There's Western classifieds. All of that is in the Tombstone Epitaph. I also want to, I did this last time, and I really want to remind people that the writers and the researchers spend all of their own time and money putting the books together that we end up getting at a library or at a bookstore or at Amazon. But please, the reason I say that is they don't make a ton of money. Like they're not millionaires off of the books that they write. They have a passion for the books. They have a passion for the research. And then they love to see the book go forth and teach people like me about a specific subject. So please, if you're thinking about buying a book or doing something with a book, please head over to, your bookstore, or not your bookstore, but yeah, bookstore where you purchase books, or Amazon. Don't buy them used because it really does help out defray the cost with the researcher and the writer. And again, I want to thank everybody listening. You can find the WWHA, the Wild West History Association, on Facebook. You can find them on Instagram, my good friend Dave Guyton. Pam and Dave and the team are putting out some great content on YouTube, so you can find us there. You can find us on Facebook. Please join, subscribe, become a member. We're just tons of stuff. And if you're looking for me, you can find me at Cochise County_travels. That's Cochise County underscore travels on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube. So I put out some content on YouTube. I just uploaded the new Wyatt Earp experience. It's about a 5-minute video of the experience in Pella, Iowa. So please, you know, go to that and hit the subscribe button. As always, I thank you guys a bunch. Safe travels, and we'll see you soon.